From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Should Boston police monitor social media? Civil libertarians say no, but Boston Mayor Marty Walsh says he supports a planned Boston Police Department surveillance program.
It's gone to a whole different level of social media, and it's important for us to stay up on what people are doing, particularly people that want to hurt people.
Plus, President-elect Donald Trump tweets that America should greatly strengthen and expand its nuclear capability. We'll get a reaction from the Harvard researcher who helped negotiate the latest U.S.-Russia non-proliferation treaty. Also today, we speak with the winner of the 2017 TED Prize, a Harvard doctor who's revolutionizing healthcare in his home country of Liberia.
In Liberia, we believe that comprehensive community-based care can serve as a model for rebuilding rural healthcare in post-war countries around the world.
All that coming up this hour on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Here's a familiar storyline in a police procedural. Officer goes undercover, befriends folks, infiltrates a group, and in some cases gets the right person, in other cases maybe not. Now, think about exactly that happening, but all online, through social media. Observations, surveillance, undercover friending, tracking. Those are some of the options that the Boston Police Department is pursuing with a $1.4 million investment it wants to make in social media monitoring software. The BPD says it's an essential modern policing tool to protect Boston from threats. Critics, including the ACLU, have said that monitoring social media accounts threatens civil rights and liberties and says that the software could target minorities and have a chilling effect on free speech. Now, we've reached out to the Boston Police Department, but no one from BPD could join us on the air. However, the Arlington Police Department has adopted a social media monitoring system called Social Sentinel, and Arlington Police Chief Fred Ryan joins us now in the studio. Chief Ryan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Also with us today is Cade Crockford. She's Director of the Technology for Liberty program at the ACLU of Massachusetts. Cade, welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
Now, Chief Ryan, just to make it explicitly clear, I understand you, of course, can't comment on anything that the Boston Police Department itself is choosing to do. But what we wanted, why we were glad that you could join us today, is to just walk us through some of the reasonings and some of the software that Arlington is using. When did it adopt its Social Sentinel software?
Right. So this becomes a function of public policy and the decision amongst our municipality as to whether we should have situational awareness as to what's occurring out there in social media in our jurisdiction. There's no question that social media has become the conduit of conversation. And it's our position that it would be irresponsible not to have some software program to enable us to be situationally aware of the conversation that's occurring in publicly facing social media posts in our jurisdiction, to keep our schools safe, to prevent the lone actor gunmen. We've seen what's happened in schools across the country, and so it becomes a policy decision around should we have a software program to enable us to do that. And then once we make the decision that we think that that's a responsible policy decision, to go out into the marketplace and acquire a software to
so enable. you have this software.
We have.
And when did you acquire it?
So we're in our second year with a company known as Social Sentinel. Uh-huh. Which is really the next generation social media. It's very important to make the distinction between social media monitoring and social media alert systems. And Social Sentinel is the latter. It is an alert system. It's essentially a virtual burglar alarm. So if there is harmful language being communicated out via numerous social media platforms, we will get an alarm. And it comes, via text and emails and so forth, so that we can go out and mitigate. And in some instances, it's around self-harm. We can prevent people experiencing suicidal ideations.
Okay, so I'm going to come back to you in just a moment. But Cade Crockford from the Massachusetts ACLU, let me get your first reaction here. As Chief Ryan and other members of law enforcement have said, our online lives are as much of a part of our real lives as anything anymore. So why not have law enforcement tools apply there?
Sure. It's apples to oranges, though, to compare what the chief has just described, this system, to what the Boston Police Department intends to purchase. The BPD intends to spend as much as $1.4 million buying a social media software monitoring program that enables all sorts of kinds of things that are quite different from what the chief just described, including, as you mentioned, developing and maintaining multiple online covert profiles so that law enforcement officials can entrap people maybe online into illegal activity or something like that, as well as the ability to download dossiers on individuals across social media platforms automatically. So in other words, to pull from your Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Snapchat, everything into one dossier so that an official can just pop it open in the morning and see everything that you did yesterday.
All right,
maybe
so I just want to
everywhere you went yesterday.
I just want to jump in here just for a second because let's break it down into little pieces. I mean, first of all, react specifically to what Chief Ryan says that they are using in Arlington, sort of like a burglar alert system was the analogy that he used. Certain language phrases
right.
are used that would attract the attention of police, of law enforcement in Arlington. The ACLU has no problem with that?
I would need to learn more about the details of how the system works in Arlington and what kinds of keywords they're looking for and things like that in order to be able to comment definitively on whether or not we have a problem with it. But I can say for sure that the chief's presence here is in stark contrast to the Boston Police Department's refusal to speak to the public, to the press, about what they intend to do. There was a city council hearing on December 5th at which members of the Boston Police Department's Fusion Center spoke to city councilors who had raised concerns about this program. And despite the Boston Police Department's pledge to be transparent in its process around acquiring this surveillance technology, they refused to provide any information to the councilors.
Okay, so there would be a long-running battle between civil libertarians and law enforcement over transparency. I will note that. But listeners, I also want to hear from you. What do you think about police, law enforcement in Boston or any city using software to monitor social media, conversations, your profiles online as a means to do modern-day policing, modern-day law enforcement? Does that make you feel safer? Does it seem like an infringement on your civil liberties? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet over social media. We're at Radio Boston. It is a way that we all communicate with each other. Chief Ryan, again, help me walk through some of the specifics. I know we're going to have a little tug of war here between Cade's concerns about Boston, and which is different from what you're doing in Arlington. I just want to acknowledge that. But I'd love to get more operational specifics from you, as much as you can give. Like when you say you're looking for keywords, I mean, Do you ever get concerned that the software might end up gathering keywords and people that are just natural language or things that look suspicious but aren't because it's just kind of the way kids talk, for
example? Right, right. And so Social Sentinel uses behavioral linguists to populate the key phrases and key searches. But I'll talk about that. But I have to respond to, Cabe mentioned, inflammatory words like entrapment. Okay. This is publicly facing social media posts.
Well, I think she was referring
there's to... There's no expectation of privacy.
But I think she was referring to the things that Boston is hoping to do and other cities have done, which is come up with fictional profiles, then friend people, which could lead to entrapment.
In the public domain, in publicly facing social media posts. And so, we need to be clear about the expectation
of
privacy.
If someone has a private account and friends someone, that allows them into the account, which then isn't necessarily publicly facing.
And that's an investigative strategy that goes on without social media monitoring or alert systems anyways. So that's an investigative strategy that's long been used by law enforcement.
So you don't see that as entrapment?
No.
Okay, well, then let me get Cade's response to that.
I mean, I think that when people, for example, encounter a beautiful woman on Twitter, right, they don't assume that there's a law enforcement official hiding behind that beautiful woman, right? Nobody knows you're a dog on the internet is an old joke, but law enforcement really, I think, can take it to an extreme in a way that's quite dangerous in terms of freedom of speech and freedom of association. And, you know, obviously we would have to pick a specific example of a case in which these kinds of powers were used inappropriately. But I have one, not about the entrapment case, but for example, you know, law enforcement often says we need this kind of technology so that we can keep track of gangs and gang members. Well, what is a gang member? In many cities in the United States, including in Boston, you can be designated as a gang member simply because of where you live and who you know, not because you have been accused of any violence, not because you have been convicted of any violence. And so that obviously impacts young men of color in our communities in Dorchester and Mattapan and Roxbury, you know, basically affects no one else. And in New York City, the New York City Police Department and the prosecutor's office there used a young man named Jelani Henry's Facebook profile simply based off of his likes and images on the internet. And because of that, charged him with conspiracy to murder someone.
Right. I'm seeing, for example, vis-a-vis those kind of cases in New York, there was a quote from Matt Mitchell, who's a researcher at a group called Crypto Harlem. They're a racial justice organization. They were concerned that he says that if you're black or brown, your social media content could become a virtual prison pipeline, you know, concerned about cases like this.
That's exactly right. Can I just finish the story
sure.
about Jelani? He was in Rikers Jail for nearly 2 years, 9 months of which he spent in solitary confinement. Ultimately, he fought it and the charges were dismissed. He was released from prison. But that's absolutely outrageous. And it wouldn't have happened if law enforcement didn't think that, you know, young black men in photographs with people who have been accused of crimes are somehow guilty.
Well, Chief Ryan, do you want to respond to that?
Well, you know, again, The Social Sentinel platform that I'm talking about is colorblind. It's a computer software program that algorithms search keywords and key phrases and alert the law enforcement agency that has jurisdiction over where the harmful language is being perpetrated. And, you know, for example, I could tweet the word kill. You know, I'd kill for a cup of coffee right now. Mm-hmm. That's not going to come up on our alert system. But the words before and after the word kill, as examined by our software, may indicate a potential threat. And we'd be notified that, you know, somebody is intending to do some harm. And I applaud what the Boston PD is doing. I think their failure to do so. Listen, this will become the standard of care in jurisdictions across America.
So let me ask you about this, because I think there's a question of sort of standards and practices as well, because I was looking at some research from Brendan McQuaid. He's a professor at the State University of New York in Cortland, studies law enforcement and intelligence operations. And what he was worried about is he was talking about that, like, real criminal activity isn't going to be done on publicly facing social media posts anyway. And so he said it's bad criminal tradecraft to broadcast your stuff on social media. So he's concerned that ultimately, these tools will be used, geared towards more political policing. He was talking about. We saw that happen in Ferguson.
Well, I have evidence to the contrary right here in front of me. We had an alert through our alert system regarding some drug activity at a local theater where somebody was arranging for a drug deal. That was given to our drug control officers, and I'm sure they'll investigate it. So I have evidence to the contrary of that. And furthermore, there's research going on right now funded by the European Union over at the Hebrew University. I was just over in Israel last week getting briefed on this. And what's becoming abundantly clear at preventing the lone actor terrorists and lone actor gunmen that act out at schools is being situationally aware on social media. Hmm. And so, it's known as the Prime Project out of the Hebrew University, and I'm anxious for them to complete their work, because I think it will be very informative for policymakers around the decision whether to employ social media alert systems or monitoring. But again, I want to be clear about the distinction between monitoring and alert.
Okay. Kate, I want to get a quick response from you. We've got a ton of people who want to have their say here, so go ahead.
Yeah, on the question of political surveillance, I mean, that quote you read is absolutely right. The Boston Police Department, unfortunately, cannot be trusted in this regard. A few years ago, my office published a report based on so-called intelligence reports that we had to sue the Boston Police Department to obtain. Those reports included information about completely peaceful activists who were protesting the Iraq War, including Code Pink, Veterans for Peace, a veterans group composed mostly of Vietnam veterans. These people have never been accused of a crime, and yet they were called so-called extremists in these intelligence files created by the Boston Police Department. These files might have been shared with the FBI. Internal BPD policy at this very moment does not require that intelligence officials believe someone is involved in criminal activity before they begin spying on them, collecting information about them, even sharing information with the FBI about them.
But the 2010 policy from the Boston Regional Intelligence... Let me see.
The BRIC.
The BRIC, yeah. I want to be sure I get the acronym right. Boston Regional Intelligence
Center.
Center. That's it. Their own policy says that the BRIC would not retain information about individuals or organizations solely based on religious, political, or social views or activities.
Aha. So you struck on the exact problem with that, which is solely, right? The word in there, solely. I mean, you have to read these documents like a lawyer. And the word solely is a loophole the size of a barn door that you can drive an entire political surveillance program through. And that's exactly what we discovered when we sued the BPD.
All right, listeners, we're speaking. You just heard the voice of Cade Crockford. She's Director of Technology for the Liberty Program at the ACLU of Massachusetts. Oh, my goodness. Thank you for bearing with me and my inability to speak today. And Chief Fred Ryan, he's the Chief of Police in Arlington, Massachusetts. And we're talking about law enforcement and the use of monitoring on social media as a tool for 21st century policing. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, and lots of folks have some questions, so let's turn to them. Alex is calling from Medford. You're on the air, Alex.
Hi, Magna. I just wanted to get into it real quick where a lot of people might think this is a privacy issue, but I don't see it as such because you're posting or, you know, creating content online for people to see, and if the police aren't monitoring it or aren't, you know, going through, it seems almost a waste to just, like, have criminals self-select themselves to say, hey, I'm doing an illegal activity, and I'm going to post about it online and not get caught. Seems like, you know, just as a bystander seems wrong.
Alex, thank you so much for your call. Let me just get a quick response here from Cade Crockford. I imagine a lot of people feel like, Alex, and even, you know, Chief Ryan mentioned at the beginning, like, it's out there. Why shouldn't law enforcement be following it? And wouldn't it be a missed opportunity if they didn't?
Again, I want to be clear that the program that we're talking about that the BPD wants to buy is nothing like the program that the chief has described as operative in Arlington. It's an entirely different bag of tricks. And our concern here is that the internet is the new public square, right? I mean, you just said it. Tweet at us if you have a comment about this show. Maybe people are afraid to tweet at you what they really think because they fear that the Boston Police Department will be keeping information about them in some dossier that will be shared with Trump's FBI. This is not just a conjecture. Plenty of studies have shown that when people think they're being monitored by the government, they censor themselves. That is something that happens in authoritarian societies that should not happen in the United States. And I want to also be very clear that the ACLU is not saying that the Boston Police Department cannot look at Twitter. As Commissioner Evans has said repeatedly over the past month, they already do that. They already have social media monitoring programs. What we're talking about is opposition, which is not just from the ACLU, but hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, actually thousands, over 2,000 people have contacted their elected officials in the city about this, who think that this is an inappropriate use of funds and that the program goes way too far in terms of what the request for proposal describes. And thirdly, that the BPD has not been forthright with the public about exactly what it intends to do.
So let's take another call here. Nancy's calling from Framingham. You're on the air, Nancy.
Hello?
Hi, Nancy. What's your thought?
Yes, hi. This whole business about the BPD listening in basically on internet traffic or whatever, it creeps me out, entirely creeps me out. I think it is, as the woman was saying, authoritarian and very, very, very threatening. as I suggested, should somebody currently type after what happened in Berlin last week, which was sickening and dreadful and all that, would to type in the word Berlin by itself or Berlin in relation to Kaiser Wilhelm Memorial Church where this happened, would that person be suspect?
Well, Nancy, great question. Let me turn back to Chief Fred Ryan on that. I mean, she's asking, like, if you're reacting to the news and the news has to do with the terrorist attack, could the software scoop you up?
Well, again, this report that I have in front of me, it came in this morning, has about 10 alerts. 9 of them were deemed to be non-credible. And so, yes, there'll be non-credible, harmful language that might come to the attention of law enforcement, but they're quickly deemed as just that, non-credible. But I got to go to bat for Boston PD here. They are recognized nationally and internationally for their community policing philosophy and the ability to build partnerships in the community, and they are the national model of community policing. And the inflammatory language like bag of tricks and entrapment is not helpful to the conversation.
I very much wish that Boston PD could have been here to respond directly.
Well, I'm happy to do that for them.
On their own behalf to the specifics that Cade Crockford and the ACLU of Massachusetts have been saying. And again, if they're listening right now, our offer is open for them to join us at this table.
Yeah, I would love to speak with them.
Any time. But point taken, Chief Ryan. I actually have another question for you, because one thing I was reading about was in departments that adopt, whatever form of social media monitoring software that they do choose, that not all of them have, for example, published procedures and practices, for example. Does Arlington sort of have a rule book on how it uses its software?
Yes. It's a policy statement like any other initiative within the department. And, July 4th, 3 years ago, somebody from Arlington was tweeting harmful language relative to firearms and shooting at the July 4th Esplanade. We were contacted by the Joint Terrorism Task Force. We were able to pay this person a visit and relieve him of his firearms.
Mm. And how long?
Quite quickly. And that was via social media. So these strategies are preventing violent crimes and preventing victimization. A lot of times we forget about victims of crimes here, and this is about preventing victimization.
How long do you retain the data that you gather through the software?
So we get daily PDF reports that are retained pursuant to the public records information, which is changing now. We just get updates. I think 3 years for stuff like that.
Three, okay.
But don't quote me on that. It's evolving law.
But you say it's in line with state rules on retention of information?
State public records retention.
Uh-huh. So we'll take a look at that a little bit later. I want to see if I can squeeze a couple more calls in here. Rebecca is calling from Falmouth. You're on the air, Rebecca.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a quick question about how does what the BPD is proposing, how does that differ from what every single internet marketing company does, where they track every keystroke you make, unless you opt out of your privacy, which is so difficult to find anywhere on any website? They track every keystroke you make.
Rebecca, thank you so much. Cade Crockford,
yeah, Rebecca,
you raised your hand to answer that
question. And the answer is pretty straightforward. Marketing companies don't have the power to conduct violence against members of the public, nor do they have the power to arrest people and deprive them of their liberty. So, when the government, when law enforcement agencies, when intelligence agencies adopt these kinds of tools, they're not trying to sell you a pair of shoes.
Let's take another call. Rodney's calling from Roxbury. You're
just
on the air,
just trying to save
Rodney.
Your life, that's all.
Rodney, Hello. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, what's your thought, Rodney?
I'm quite upset about the fact that it's garbage in, garbage out, unless you have high-quality people analyzing the data, and you have algorithms that have been debugged. Otherwise, it's going to cause a lot of problems like it has in other cities, especially in the social service area.
Rodney, thank you so much for your call. Chief Ryan, help us get some insight here. I mean, Rodney was worried basically about who's analyzing the data and how can you be sure that you get the best analysis out of it.
Yeah, and that's a great question. That's why when we went out into the marketplace to acquire the software, we were drawn to Social Sentinel. They provide their service to many colleges and universities across America, and they populate the search criteria and search algorithms along with behavioral linguists who are up to speed on evolving language and evolving acronyms and so forth that help identify harmful language that's going out in publicly facing social media. Mm-hmm. Emphasis on publicly facing.
Well, we're down to our last couple seconds. Cade, last quick thought from you.
I just wanted to note that that's a really important point because algorithms, especially when they're sold by these private companies, are proprietary. So it's oftentimes impossible, if not extremely difficult and requiring a lawsuit, for members of the public and people such as your last caller who presumably would be able to read such an algorithm to understand what its implications are for public safety and security and civil liberties to do that. So this is, you know, there's a big shroud of secrecy surrounding not just the way that law enforcement is implementing these tools, oftentimes like with respect to the BPD, but even what those tools actually are.
Well, just as a last note, again, I want to reiterate that we did reach out to the Boston Police Department today. They were unable to join us, but a BPD press spokesperson, Officer Rachel McGuire, did tell us that the BPD is still evaluating bids for its social media monitoring software. They say it's a long process. They couldn't give us more details. They have goals about specific dates that they would like to award a contract. But as far as there being a hard deadline, there isn't one. Again, that's from BPD press officer Rachel McGuire. Well, that's it for this conversation. And I want to say thank you to Chief Fred Ryan, Chief of Police in Arlington, Massachusetts. Thank you so very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And Cade Crockford, Director of the Technology for Liberty Program at the ACLU of Massachusetts. Thank you as well.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And listeners, no matter what you heard today, I really do encourage you to go online at radioboston.org and give us your comment about what you think about social media and 21st century policing. Or again, as always, you can send us your thoughts on Twitter or at Facebook. We're at Radio Boston. Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just this afternoon, President-elect Donald Trump put out this tweet. He said, quote, "The United States must greatly strengthen and expand its nuclear capability until such time as the world comes to its senses regarding nukes." Trump did not signal what prompted his tweet, but the BBC reports that it came just hours after Russian President Vladimir Putin met with his military advisors. And the BBC reports that Putin said Russia needs to, quote, strengthen the military potential of strategic nuclear forces, especially with missile complexes that can reliably penetrate any existing missile defense systems. Now, any expansion of either nation's nuclear arms would effectively reverse years of anti-proliferation efforts. It was as recently as February 2011 that the latest U.S.-Russia treaty to limit strategic nuclear weapons went into effect. That agreement is known as the New START Treaty, and Gary Seymour led the American group that negotiated it. He's also served as President Obama's White House coordinator for arms control, and he's currently executive director for research at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and he joins us now. Gary Seymour, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna. Thanks for having me on.
So there was sort of this pulse of reaction over President-elect Trump's tweet this afternoon. What's your first reaction to it, of him saying that the U.S. should greatly and expand its nuclear capability?
Well, I don't take it very seriously until we see how his actual policies come out. And whoever was elected was going to have to spend money to modernize the U.S. nuclear triad. We've reached the point where the main systems we use to deliver nuclear weapons, bombers and missiles and submarines, are going to be reaching the end of their life cycle over the next 10 to 15 years. So we're going to be spending as much as $1 trillion to modernize those forces. And any president would have to do that. So we've got to wait and see exactly how Trump translates his tweets into real policy before we can make any judgments.
Well, regarding the New START Treaty, which you negotiated with Russia, I'm seeing that there were key targets, reduction targets, that both the U.S. and Russia have to meet by 2018. Are the nations on track for that?
Yes. The New START Treaty sets a cap of 1,550 deployed strategic warheads for both sides. And the U.S. military is very confident that 1,550 nuclear weapons are more than enough for nuclear deterrence. And the Russians are also satisfied with that level. So I would be very surprised if either the U.S. and Russia would want to exceed that limit. What's going to happen instead is replacing older bombers with new bombers, older subs with new subs, older missiles with new missiles. The Russians have been doing this for a long time because their forces were wearing out sooner than ours, and now we're going to be entering a cycle where we'll have to do it over the next 10 to 15 years.
Well, I'm seeing that the BBC is reporting that President Vladimir Putin there was talking about carefully monitoring changes in, quote, the balance of power and political military situation, especially along Russian borders. Could he have possibly been referring to U.S. missile defenses in Eastern Europe?
The Russians are very concerned about U.S. missile defenses, not only in Europe, but also our national missile defense system. The Russians, I think it's very alarmist, but they're convinced that U.S. missile defenses could be used as an effective tool to negate Russia's nuclear forces in a crisis. For example, the Russians calculate that if the U.S. launched a first strike, we would destroy the vast majority of Russian nuclear forces, and whatever limited forces were left wouldn't be able to penetrate U.S. missile defenses. I can't imagine any president taking a risk like that, but when the Russians do their worst-case assessment, it makes them very nervous, and that's why they've been investing a lot of money in modernizing their nuclear forces to make them much less vulnerable to a U.S. first strike.
You know, if I may just jump in here, Gary Seymour, I feel like, you know, one of the things that President-elect Trump said during the campaign as a candidate, he said a lot of contradictory things about nuclear proliferation. You know, one is that he does believe, he said it several times, that it's one of the biggest challenges and threats the world faces. He said that. But then also in March of this year, a couple of times, he said he wasn't so sure if proliferation was a bad thing, if Saudi Arabia or South Korea or Japan, you know, built up a nuclear arsenal. And then later in March, he told CNN that proliferation is going to happen anyway. It's only a question of time. So, you know, I take your point that it's hard to imagine a U.S. president, you know, doing what you had hinted earlier. But how are we to interpret the talk that we've been hearing both earlier this year and now from the man who's to be the president of the United States and from President Putin, just the very way they're talking about nuclear weapons?
Well, I think we've learned not to take President-elect Trump's campaign statements very seriously. They're not a clearly well-thought-out set of viewpoints. He does say a lot of contradictory things, not just on nuclear weapons, but on many issues, foreign and domestic policy. So I think we've got to wait and see how his actual policies are carried out. And it will be some time, I think, before that becomes apparent, because you have a new team coming in. There are some internal tensions and disagreements among that group. They've never worked together. So I would imagine that we'll see, it'll be some time before we can really make any judgments about what Trump's actual policies are toward nuclear weapons and many other things as well.
Well, Gary Seymour is the Executive Director for Research at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He also led the American interagency group that negotiated the New START Treaty with Russia back in 2010. That treaty went into effect in 2011. Gary Seymour, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Magnus. Happy to do it.
Well, let's turn now to Ken Kimmel. He's the president of the Union of Concerned Scientists. He's also former commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, and he joins us now in the studio. Ken Kimmel, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, you heard our conversation just now with Gary Seymour. The Union of Concerned Scientists has been calling for an end to nuclear weapons testing and deployment since, what, the 1970s. So just your first reaction on what the president-elect has tweeted and Gary Seymour's seemed to stress that we shouldn't be too worried about it.
Well, I would say I think all of us, including the media, actually read too much into Donald Trump's tweets and pay too much attention to them, to be honest. So I'm not going to read too much into it. I will say this, though, that to the extent the tweet is calling for a buildup as opposed to a modernization, but a buildup of our nuclear weapons, it's the year 2016. The Soviet Union is gone. The Berlin Wall fell 25 years ago. We are not in an arms race with Russia or anyone else. The only legitimate purpose, if there is one, for nuclear weapons is to deter an attack. Our military has made it clear for many years that we have more than enough nuclear weapons to credibly deter anyone from attacking us with nuclear weapons. So we don't see any need for a nuclear buildup, and we're quite certain that we can't afford one as well.
I mean, Gary Samer was talking about spending $1 trillion in order to modernize the extant arsenal.
Yeah, I think there's no reality to that number, and I can't imagine that Congress would appropriate that kind of money.
Well, Ken Kimmel, we originally had invited you into the studio to talk about the Department of Energy overall and the appointment or the naming of Rick Perry to be as the nominee for the future Secretary of Energy. And I still want to have that conversation in the couple minutes that we have, because I'm curious, because obviously nuclear falls under the purview of the Department of Energy. I mean, your thoughts about Rick Perry as the person that President-elect Trump has named to that cabinet position?
Sure. Well, I think, first of all, you have to look at the nomination of Rick Perry as part of a trio, because we also have the nomination of Rex Tillerson, the CEO of the world's largest oil and gas company, as Secretary of State, and the nomination of Scott Pruitt, the Attorney General of Oklahoma, who has literally turned his Attorney General's office into something of a legal defense fund for the oil and gas industry. So add to that Rick Perry, former governor of Texas with extensive ties to the fossil fuel industry, and one really has to be concerned about a cabinet that is of, by, and for the oil and gas industry.
And, but if I could just jump in here for a second, to be fair, I mean, as governor of Texas, Rick Perry brought a lot of wind power to Texas, for example.
Right. And actually, with respect to Rick Perry, it's a mixed bag. So that is something that we've noted about his record and written about and we're encouraged by. He led an investment of about $7 billion in public funds to build out transmission lines. And now Texas generates much more wind energy than any state in the country. Thousands of people are paid with good jobs in that industry. Landowners get royalties, and the energy is so cheap that they literally give it away at night. So that's a huge success story. And we are cautiously optimistic that Rick Perry could convince his new boss, Donald Trump, that transitioning to a clean energy economy is actually really good for the American economy. It is not something to be feared or to be pared back. So that's the good side. That's the good news. The bad news, though, is this. Rick Perry is a self-professed climate science denier. He's said that repeatedly. That is profoundly troubling when you think of the Department of Energy, which is our premier science and technology agency. I tried to think of an analogy for it, and the best I could come up with is it's a little bit like having a surgeon general who denies that cigarettes cause cancer. So that's really worrisome, and one has to hope that the Rick Perry, who was governor of Texas, who brought the wind energy to Texas, is the one who shows up for work and not the climate science denier.
Well, Ken Kimmel is president of the Union of Concerned Scientists. He's also former commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. He held that post between 2011 and 2014. Ken Kimmel, thank you so very much for joining us in the studio today. And listeners, we just had two guests who told us that maybe the media pays a little too much attention to the tweets sent out by President-elect Donald Trump. I'm curious what you think about that. Send us a tweet. Yes, a tweet. But send us a tweet at Radio Boston and let us know if you agree or disagree. Because we also had, you know, for example, 8 years of President Obama, and sometimes he was afraid to say things about race, for example, for fear that the media might read too much into it. But on the other hand, we now have President-elect Donald Trump, who doesn't seem to hold any of those same fears. Should we be looking in carefully into what the president-elect is tweeting or not? Guide us. Send us a tweet at Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Now, you might roll your eyes at all those magazine rankings out there, top places to live, top colleges, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And honestly, I do share your skepticism, and I want to acknowledge that. But still, I think Massachusetts can and should blush with more than a little bit of pride about the latest index out from Bloomberg Markets today. The Financial News Group published its 2016 ranking of most innovative states in America, and for the second year in a row, Massachusetts ranks number one. Good job, Bay State. Beat California by 1 point, beat Washington State by 2 points. And here's why having Apple or Microsoft wasn't enough for those two states, because Bloomberg ranked the states along six different metrics: R&D intensity, productivity, high-tech density, concentration of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics employment, science and engineering degree holders, and patent activity. So they're really looking at innovation in the science and tech areas. And I want to acknowledge that innovation can, of course, exist outside of those sectors. But it's not market cap, obviously, that matters, but how densely research and education are clustered, according to Bloomberg. So again, bravo, Bay State. It's great to be the most innovative state in the U.S. Now, let's put some of those smarts to coming up with innovative solutions to some of our bigger challenges, like income inequality and housing. Let's do it. We can do it. Okay, so while I've got your attention about innovation, I want to introduce you to another Massachusetts innovator. He is Dr. Raj Punjabi. In 2005, when Dr. Punjabi returned to his home country of Liberia, a civil war had wiped out much of the medical infrastructure in the country of 4 million people. In fact, there were only 51 doctors in all of Liberia. Punjabi says that would be like if Boston only had 8 doctors for the whole city. So Dr. Punjabi vowed to build an army of community health workers in Liberia to rebuild that infrastructure and to prevent what he called anonymous deaths. Dr. Raj Punjabi has been awarded the $1 million 2017 TED Prize for his efforts, and he joins us now. Dr. Raj Punjabi, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So before we talk about exactly what you did to rebuild Liberia's medical infrastructure, can you just give us a bigger picture in terms of how deep the disaster was for healthcare in Liberia in the, you know, before and during the Ebola crisis?
Sure. I had been privileged to be born there, fled during the conflict as a child, went back as a medical student about 12 years ago. And when I got back home, it was just devastating. You know, you expect physical destruction after war, and we had a lot of that. I mean, even as far as no traffic lights, no running water, no electricity in the capital city where I'd grown up. We also had a lot of human devastation. We just had 51 doctors, again, to serve a country of 4 million people. What that meant was if you got sick in the city where those doctors were primarily clustered, you might stand a chance. But if you got sick in remote rural communities where I had been asked by the Ministry of Health to work in, you would often die anonymously. I mean, that's because if you fell sick, imagine a 2-year-old falling sick with a fever, mom would have to take you to a riverbed, get in a canoe, and walk sometimes up to 2 days just to get a diagnosis in a clinic.
Huh. And of course, then this problem, the effects of this problem were only exacerbated unimaginably by the Ebola crisis.
Well, and that's right, and in many ways related to them. So we know that right after the war, Liberia public spending was about $3 per person per year. I mean, you know, U.S. is spending several thousand dollars per person per year in comparison. We had increased that spending tenfold up until the crisis in 2014, but those dollars and the investments had not reached the remote rural corners of the country. We know that because even across the border from us in southern Guinea, a 2-year-old named Emil would come down with what would turn out to be Ebola, but it took 3 months between December 2013, March 2014 for it to be diagnosed and confirmed. And partly that's because there's a lack of a health worker in those communities and a lack of a health system to support that health worker. So, you know, what we've learned working in Liberia after the war, but also during the Ebola crisis, is that the fault lines of inequality, the lack of the maldistribution of healthcare services and health workers, lines up a lot with the fault lines of poverty and the fault lines of where globalization has not reached. They've not reached rural communities.
Yeah. So, of course, the Ebola outbreak was in 2014, and the work that you were doing there to expand community health workers was going on before that. I should acknowledge that. But take us back to how and when you were inspired to build this army, as we said earlier, of community health workers in Liberia. I understand that it came from a model that you actually saw working in rural Alaska.
That's right. So community health workers, the idea that you could take a someone that's not educated more than high school, sometimes middle to high school level, and give them within a matter of months some training to provide primary medical care, supervised by a nurse or a physician, but going door to door in their own home communities to provide medical care for conditions like malaria, up to providing patients with HIV, with treatment support. That is all possible to do. I had been exposed to this model in rural Alaska. In the tundra there in Bethel, Alaska, there have been for decades a number of remote rural communities that have employed local women and men who are not educated more than high school. To be the equivalent of community health workers who are providing at that time care for patients with high blood pressure, with conditions like mental illness. And so that inspired us. When I went back home to Liberia, I was seeing the same issue. You know, there's about 400 million to a billion people on the planet who do not have access to health care because they live too far from a clinic. And we thought, well, no one should die because they live too far from a clinic. Mm-hmm. Could we use a similar approach in Liberia to train our people, rural local people, as community health workers? And so that's how we got started. And I'm happy to share an example of one that's useful. But we've now managed to employ about over 300 of these community health professionals, including nurses to support them, serving about 50,000 people across 2.5 million acres of rainforest.
Oh yeah, so I'd love an example. I mean, give us an example of what one of these workers have done, who they reach out to, what kind of work they do.
Sure. I just got back from Liberia this weekend. I was with one last week, a community health worker named Abadengo, and he is working in a community in an area called Riverses, where only 2 years ago there was an Ebola outbreak. And what Abadengo, the reason I was visiting him, and I had to take a canoe up river for about an hour and then hike through the forest for another hour to link up with him. Well, the reason I was visiting him was to follow up on a little baby, actually an infant, that he had found out was suffering from malnutrition. Imagine a child being 6 months old but only weighing what a one-month-old weighs. This was a child that was extremely emaciated when Abadengo found him back in February. He screened him for malnutrition, discovered that, in fact, this child was very malnourished, got him to a hospital. He was able to get medical care. He was discharged from the hospital back up the river through the forest. And then, of course, mom needed support. Mom, who was only 16 years old, needed support to support the child. So there's this ready-to-use therapeutic food, almost a peanut butter-like paste, that mom needed to give alongside the other food she was giving the child. And Abadengo was able to accompany her and make sure that she was able to feed the child. So I was there assessing his developmental milestones and happy to report, while he still has a lot of growth and recovery to do, he's meeting his developmental milestones. He's a little boy who can now, around the age of one, able to pull himself up with his hands to a stand, and is able to try to mouth some words. So, you know, that's one patient and one community health worker. What I didn't tell you is Abadengo is only eighth grade educated and has never had a chance to go beyond middle school. But yet he was able to, within a matter of months, learn some of the most important medical skills that could save the lives of children in his community.
Wow. Well, the Liberian government has recognized the power and success of the model of healthcare that you're helping launch there, and they're in the process of nationalizing it, I understand. Dr. Punjabi, we only have a couple minutes left, and I do want to ask you, you sort of hinted at it a little earlier that you had to leave Liberia as a child. You were, what, 9 years old then?
I was nine.
Yeah, and the country was on the brink of war, and you had to leave on a cargo plane. So, I mean, your own story is quite incredible as it is. So I'm just curious, every time you go back and you see the work that Abadengo and his colleagues are doing under your program, what does that mean to you?
You know, I think, you know, and this has been a year of such tumult for the world, I think what Liberia and that experience during the war and the coming back home has taught me is that we as people We as patients, we as citizens, we're not defined by the crises that strike our lives. We're defined, in fact, by how we respond to them. Liberia was once known as a poster child for armies of child soldiers. I hope now, with the stories of people like Abadengo, if we can throw more support behind them, we'll be known for armies of compassion, full of nurses and community health workers who are able to reach patients anywhere and everywhere. So, you know, I think that's what being a physician has taught me. I'm really grateful to Harvard Medical School for training, for giving me the opportunity to learn and go back and be supportive of it, and grateful for my colleagues at Last Mile Health. But fundamentally, that's what I think I've learned from it.
Well, Dr. Raj Punjabi is CEO and co-founder of Last Mile Health and an associate physician at Harvard Medical School. Just this month, he was awarded the TED Prize, the 2017 TED Prize. It's worth $1 million. Are you allowed to tell us what organization or what you're going to use that $1 million for yet?
Well, it'll build on the work, but I'll announce it live from the TED stage in April, so tune in.
Okay, we'll definitely tune in and hope to have you back shortly after that. Dr. Punjabi, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Meg.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.